This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For Black History Month 1993, join me now for part two in a series of four programs.
There's a story that when President Lincoln, after long debate within his cabinet and within himself, signed the final Emancipation Proclamation in January 1863, witnesses noticed that his hand was shaking. This tremor suggests for some historians that Lincoln feared he was making a terrible mistake. Some members of the cabinet worried about the consequences of creating a large, free black population before steps had been taken for their colonization outside the country. Though Lincoln was proposing only to emancipate slaves held in states that were in rebellion, certain cabinet members feared that the loyal border states would feel threatened and swing back toward the Confederacy.
Andrew DelBanco of Columbia University reading from the introduction to his new book, The Portable Lincoln. In just a moment, Andrew DelBanco discusses race, American political culture, and the writings of Abraham Lincoln. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Andrew DelBanco is a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia University. He's the editor of The Portable Lincoln, a new collection of more than 80 of Lincoln's writings, ranging from the Emancipation Proclamation and the Gettysburg Address to the second inaugural address and less well-known letters and memoranda. The Portable Lincoln presents a kind of chronology of Lincoln's professional life. It also provides both the pleasures and the benefits of the work of a great writer. But The Portable Lincoln also emphasizes the moral issues that underscored Lincoln's presidency, among them the volatile political question of the Emancipation Proclamation. There's an apocryphal story, for instance, that as he signed it, Lincoln's hand was trembling. I asked Andrew DelBanco to explain.
Well, Wayne, this is one of the many unprovable stories about Lincoln, that when he reached for the pen to sign the document, some of the people in the room with him noticed that his hand was trembling. And historians have argued about many things concerning Lincoln, and one thing they've argued about is, what did this mean? Did it mean that he was conscious of the fact that this was an epical moment which he had brought about, and he was trembling because of his sense of the weight of responsibility in making this great change in the history of mankind? Or did it mean that he was nervous and concerned that he had made the wrong decision and was full of doubts that the political consequences would be terrible? Or didn't it happen at all, and is it just some ornament that was placed on his reputation?
Well, now you point out in your introduction to The Portable Abraham Lincoln that the fact is we'll never know, but this is the kind of story that is part and parcel of what another historian has called getting right with Lincoln, that is, figuring out how to understand the images and the myth. Talk to me about that for a moment.
Well, Lincoln, because he's so central to our history and to our sense of ourselves, is a very vivid reminder of how elusive that history is and how it means so many different things to different people, depending on the perspective from which we look. The image of Lincoln has changed virtually with every generation in American history. When he assumed office, he was reviled and ridiculed as an absurd character out of the prairies. Contemporary cartoonists made him look like a pretzel or a rail or a snake. After his assassination, his image rather suddenly changed, and many eulogists spoke about him after his death, compared him outright to Christ himself, mm-hmm. and talked about how he had spoken in parables all his life and carried the nation's sins upon his shoulders.
Let's hold that in abeyance for a moment, Andy DelBanco. I want to come back to the image and the myth building surrounding Lincoln. Right now, I want you to tell me how we differentiate among and between these very important historical terms, anti-black, anti-slavery, emancipation, the notion of the republic itself. These are tall orders, but I'm asking you to summarize and tell me how Lincoln thought about them and how we make sense of them today.
Yeah. Well, one of the debates that have raged around Lincoln is the question of what his attitudes on racial questions really were. And it's often said in our own time, when racial feelings continue to run high, that Lincoln was, in fact, himself a racist. Lincoln said outright, and his words are always the best words to use when trying to convey his convictions, that he hated slavery. For example, he explained in his famous speech on the Kansas-Nebraska Act, when he was speaking about Senator Douglas, he spoke about his declared indifference, but as I must think, covert real zeal for the spread of slavery, that is Douglas's, I cannot but hate. I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world, enables the enemies of free institutions with plausibility to taunt us as hypocrites, causes the real friends of freedom to doubt our sincerity, and especially because it forces so many really good men amongst ourselves into an open war with the very fundamental principles of civil liberty, criticizing the Declaration of Independence and insisting that there is no right principle of action but self-interest.
All right, now this, I take it, your argument would be this is at the heart of Lincoln's attitude toward race and slavery.
I think it is. Now, of course, to say that Lincoln hated slavery is not to say that he was not beset and limited by some of the racial attitudes of his own time.
Again, let me stop you. You say, for instance, that he talked to various audiences in various, he presented various facets of this large argument.
Yes. Well, for instance, when he spoke to audiences in southern Illinois, where he realized that some of the sentiments we associate with the South might have been well represented, he had a different way of talking than when he talked to audiences in Connecticut or in New York. He would make remarks like, just because I think a black man has the right to own his own labor doesn't mean that I want to take a black woman for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And these remarks were, of course, from our perspective, ways of pandering to the racial attitudes of his audience. And there's no doubt that that was the case. This was a politician to his toenails. But if one looks for the consistent principles within Lincoln's position on these questions over time, I think it's very hard not to have the impression that he regards slavery as a tragical inheritance that the American Republic has to deal with. And he's very, very tentative when he makes statements about the black man's inferiority to the white man. For example, here is Senator Douglas in the first debate with Lincoln. I am opposed to Negro citizenship in any and every form. I believe this government was made on the white basis. I believe it was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever, and I am in favor of confining citizenship to white men, men of European birth and descent, instead of conferring it upon Negroes, Indians, and other inferior races.
How does Lincoln respond to that?
I, as well as Judge Douglas, am in favor of the race to which I belong, having the superior position. I have never said anything to the contrary. But I hold that notwithstanding all this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Let's come back to this question of the images that surround Abraham Lincoln. You intimated at the outset of our conversation that we have this long line of images. I can think of writers like Carl Sandburg, Walt Whitman, James Agee. Tell me about this lineage.
Well, every generation, it seems, has to come to terms with Lincoln, or in David Donald's words, get right with Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
In the 30s, we had a Lincoln who was a kind of populist Westerner striding eastward from the Great Prairie to straighten things out in a messed up country. In the 50s, we had Lincoln as a kind of resolute cold warrior who stood up against the frightening power, the conspiratorial power of the slave order, and carried the moral high ground. More recently, we've had Lincoln as a kind of tactician, and I suspect that at the present moment, the Lincoln who appeals to us so powerfully is Lincoln the problem solver. Lincoln who somehow managed to cut through the political chaos that seemed to be enveloping the country and bring it out into the clearing, bring it out into the fresh air, and show it its real identity.
You're telling me that Lincoln's like a movie, Andy. We project him onto the screen of our own minds. Is it therefore impossible to get to the man himself? You say, for example, in The Portable Lincoln, there's so many obstacles, and there's a kind of an eerie impersonality to this man. Is he lost forever, therefore?
I don't think so, and I think, in fact, that's one reason why I found it a challenge to put together a small but substantial collection of his writings, because I think it's a bit like arguments over the Bible. You know, you can take any piece from a Lincoln speech and use it to promote any position you have with regard to him. But if you read the works in breadth and try to come to terms with the general spirit of the man, I should think it would be possible to come to a general agreement on what it was he stood for.
What should we make of a phrase such as the following? Lincoln wrote American. Here again, in your introduction to The Portable Lincoln, you quote Shelby Foote. What does that mean?
Well, one of the pleasures of reading Lincoln, and I think one of the sources of his appeal in our own time, is how directly he cut through all the political bombast, which in the 1850s was something of a peak in our political history.
Well, that's a bit of a consolation after what we've been through.
You know, Senator Douglas would get up on the platform and speak in rather pretentious terms, lots of polysyllabic words. And Lincoln would get up and say something like, well, you know, I just can't get this guy off of the Kansas-Nebraska idea. It's like an animal that's got its teeth fastened on a bone. And, you know, clearly Lincoln knew how to speak to his audience. He also was a master of metaphor. When he spoke, for instance, of slavery in the Constitution in the Cooper Union Address as a wen or cancer that must be cut out. He made his point.
Images that come home to the audience that they can identify, that listeners can identify with.
Yeah.
Why did Walt Whitman call Lincoln, let me get this right, the sweet democratic despot of the West? That's a wonderful phrase. Unpack that for me.
Well, there are three adjectives there, and they're all interesting. Let's start with the last one. Despot was something that Lincoln was often accused of being. He, although when he came into office, people thought he would be ineffectual and bumbling. It turned out, in fact, that he was a master manipulator, both of his own cabinet, of his generals, although they gave him trouble for a while, and of opposing politicians throughout the states. And he was not above throwing political opponents in jail. On the grounds of that they were subverting the cause of the Union. He was not above suspending the rule of habeas corpus when he thought the interests of the Republic were threatened. He took many actions in wartime that we would regard out of that context as shockingly undemocratic. Democratic, Whitman's second adjective, I think I would have to revert to my feeling that Lincoln, although he was beset by some of the same racial attitudes that all his contemporaries carried about with them, believed fundamentally that the principles of the Declaration of Independence were the bedrock of the Republic. The equality idea was what drove Lincoln, and which he often said were the principles on which he based every action in his life. And sweet, that's a hard one. I suppose I do feel, as Whitman does, a kind of sweetness in Lincoln's vision, because he has ultimately an optimism about human nature and a generosity of spirit, which enables him, for instance, to speak much more compassionately about Southern whites than many of his political allies within the Republican Party in the North. Let me give you an example. The great majority, South as well as North, have human sympathies, of which they can no more divest themselves than they can of their sensibility to physical pain. These sympathies in the bosoms of the Southern people manifest in many ways their sense of the wrong of slavery and their consciousness that, after all, there is humanity in the Negro.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to the second program in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1993. My guest is Andrew Del Banco, a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia University. Andrew Del Banco is the editor of The Portable Lincoln, recently published in paperback by Viking. The Portable Lincoln is a collection of more than 80 speeches and writings representing Lincoln's personal and political career and his literary abilities as one of the premier stylists of 19th century America. You say, for example, Andy Del Banco, that Lincoln was capable of inhabiting the Southern mind. I take it this is what you're drawing on here.
Yes, I think Lincoln understood. He didn't understand Southerners as minions of the devil who needed to be extirpated or brought around to a consciousness of their own sinfulness, which is what so many of the abolitionists believed. He saw them, I think, instead as prisoners of history. He saw them as inheritors of an institution that they didn't invent. And he said more than once, many times in his career, that if he were a Southern politician in the late 1850s, he himself would not know what to do about the existing institution of slavery. He, of course, took the position that he, as president, had the constitutional authority only to enforce the exclusion of slavery from the territories. He never, until that day in January 1, 1863, he never took the position that he had the authority to banish slavery where it existed in the southern states. And one of the historical arguments that rages about over Lincoln is, how is it that he came to that view? Some believe that it was largely through the exigencies of the war itself, when, as the Union soldiers moved deeper into southern territory and found themselves saddled with larger and larger numbers of ex-slaves who were seeking protection from their former masters, that it simply became a military necessity. Something had to be done with these people, and it didn't make any economic or military sense to return them to the very masters that that they were fighting against. Others believe that Lincoln felt the opportunity to sign that emancipation as a great fulfillment or culmination of his anti-slavery principles. It's an argument that goes on and on.
You say, for example, Andy Del Banco, in The Portable Abraham Lincoln, that the president's principles may still prove impossible to realize as the foundations of a civil society. Should we make of your argument there a fundamental pessimism about what Lincoln stood for example, with respect to race?
Well, if you cut to the heart of what Lincoln was about, I think you find yourself in the company of a man who took the opening lines of the Declaration of Independence ultimately seriously. All men are created equal. And he said more than once that for him that included black men. He looked about him and he saw a house divided, a republic in which a great number of people considered human beings with black skin to belong to them as property. And he was damned if he knew how to deal with that problem. He began to deal with it by compelling slavery to remain where it was. And eventually, under a variety of political and military pressures, he took the step of attacking slavery where it existed. I think if we take Lincoln's principles seriously, that is, his loyalty to the Declaration, we have to recognize that in our own time, the racial divisions in American society continue to run very, very deep. And we continue to be challenged by the question of whether we can make this republic be true to its basic founding principles.
Let's enlarge the scope of our conversation some, Andy Del Banco. You wear many hats. In this instance, you're an editor. You wrote an introduction to The Portable Lincoln. You are a professor of English, American literature at Columbia. You also say in this introduction that that some of our major writers — major is a word that is much out of fashion these days — but our principal writers back there on the horizon were themselves prescient about the very issues that Lincoln is aware of. And you mention, for instance, Melville and Hawthorne. Tell me about that very briefly.
Well, it's often struck me that if you look at the portrait of Captain Ahab in Moby Dick, you have a pretty good version of Lincoln himself. almost 10 years before Lincoln emerged as a national figure. This is a man driven, obsessed, willing to do anything it takes to get the crew behind him in his quest, and a man who speaks of hatred, of hating the whale, in much the same way that Lincoln speaks of hating slavery. Hawthorne's work, especially a book like The Scarlet Letter, is fascinated and disturbed by the prospect that the culture itself was dividing in such a way that no sort of consensus could be established anymore. If you remember in The Scarlet Letter, Dimmesdale's biggest problem, it seems, is to convince his audience that he is in fact what he is. He says, "I stand before you, the greatest sinner of all," and half the audience takes him seriously and half the audience thinks it's a rhetorical flourish.
Mm-hmm.
He bares his chest to show the Scarlet A branded into his flesh, and half the people say they haven't seen anything.
And in like fashion, in Moby Dick, you have little Pip, the young black character in this novel, standing in front of this doubloon that Ahab has posted on the mast of the ship to give to the first man who sees the whale. And all he does is conjugate a verb. There is no real continuity or understanding there.
Yes.
And I take you're arguing that this is, again, emblematic of Lincoln.
Well, I'm arguing that Lincoln understood profoundly that the Republic was quite literally fragmenting into a variety of perception communities, if you like. You could call it something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that by the sheer force of his own personal will, he embarked on the process of holding it together and forcing it to confront its history and to agree on its basic principle.
Andy DelBanco, we're talking about your portable Abraham Lincoln. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Read me another excerpt here, will you please?
Of all Lincoln's speeches, I think probably the greatest, even greater than the Gettysburg Address in some respects, is the second inaugural, in which he says, "If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether."
Here's an instance of political religion, the way Lincoln skillfully draws on religion, religiosity, and combines it with our political discourse.
Well, there were many remarkable things about that passage. One of them is that he is able to see and to say that the responsibility for slavery is shared by North and South. Not many wartime leaders speak about the complicity of their own people. It is also remarkable in the sense that he insists, at a time when chance seemed to be ruling the world more and more and when religious faith seemed to be harder and harder to maintain, he insists that the events and the fate and the destiny of the nation are within what he calls the providence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And he manages, despite the horror of the war, to see it as part of a historical process that's moving toward revelation or toward light, toward illumination of the human mind with respect to its responsibilities to its fellow man.
Apropos of that comment, Andy, here's a final question for you. Your current interest as a scholar, you're writing a book about evil in the American mind, and in your introduction to The Portable Lincoln, you talk about locating evil with respect to our Civil War, questions of race and ethnicity. Give me an update about that book, would you?
Well, the book is coming along, and as I work through it, I continue to find myself going back to Lincoln, because Lincoln strikes me in many respects as the last public man in America who was able to speak seriously about the problem of evil, to speak about it without demagoguery, without cynicism, to understand that it's a problem that we all have to come to terms with.
A footnote, finally, to our conversation, Andy DelBanco. Do you have a favorite line from Lincoln, something that resonates in your mind?
One thing that comes to mind is Lincoln's remark when he was faced with lots of specious arguments about how slavery wasn't so bad and Northern abolitionists were misrepresenting it for political purposes. He said very simply, "People seldom run unless there's something to run from." In his characteristic way, he cut through all the cant and got to the heart of the matter.
Andy DelBanco, I want to thank you for coming by the National Humanities Center. Your book is The Portable Abraham Lincoln. It's out now in paperback from Viking. You are a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Andy. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
It's Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to the second program in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1993. My guest was Andrew DelBanco, a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia University. Andrew DelBanco is the editor of The Portable Lincoln, available in paperback from Viking. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 646. That's program number 646, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The Center welcomes your comments. Next week, part three of Soundings for Black History Month 1993. My guests will be Melton McLaurin and Herman Bennett, professors of history at the University of North Carolina. Melton McLaurin will talk about his book, Celia, a Slave. Herman Bennett will discuss the transatlantic slave trade and the African diaspora. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Black History Month, the second segment in a series of four discussions, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and conversation featuring the editor of The Portable Lincoln. Andrew DelBanco of Columbia University will be here to talk about Abraham Lincoln, race, American politics, the Civil War, and the Emancipation Proclamation. The Portable Lincoln, some answers and insights for Black History Month, this week on Soundings.